From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered, where we gather the highlights from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Guy Raz. This episode, the money men pouring millions of their own cash into the election.
Without question, this is going to be the most expensive federal election cycle in U.S. history.
We'll speak with one billionaire who's given a pro-Mitt Romney super PAC $1.25 million. Also, Memorial Day memories from veterans and the comrades who never made it home.
And I learned that my beloved twin brother was killed first day of the Battle of Bulge.
And later, how a Stanford education made Tablo one of Korea's most famous rap artists.
Part of the irony of this is that in the United States, if a rapper went to Stanford, it might be held against him.
Plus, director Peter Berg on the movie he could watch a million times and distilling a life into a single movie trailer.
In a world where a voice can separate the boys from the men, one 15-year-old is walking the line and charting his own destiny.
And two great music segments, Venezuelan piano virtuoso Vanessa Perez performs for us, and why the Denver-based band The Lumineers may change your life. That's all in this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. I've been trying to do it right. Our cover story today, how unlimited money is already changing the way elections are won and lost.
Test, test, test.
A few days ago, we called up a hotshot political consultant named Matt Makowiak. He's a rising star in the very lucrative world of political consulting. His firm is called the Potomac Strategy Group, and he helps Republicans win elections. Okay, so you are a Republican consultant. Why aren't you working on Romney's campaign?
I haven't been asked.
Matt Makowiak is laughing not because he doesn't want Romney to win. To the contrary, he really does want him to win. But people who are part of Makowiak's tribe, the strategists, the opposition researchers, the pollsters, increasingly they're discovering that they can have a much bigger impact working for outside groups that can raise unlimited amounts of money. I asked Makowiak if he had a choice, either work the Romney campaign or for an outside group backing conservative values, which would he pick?
Boy, and that's you know, an interesting question, because I think probably before this cycle, before the Citizens United decision, which I guess was just before the 2010 cycle, in most cases you'd say presidential campaign. The outside groups and the independent expenditures were seen as sort of a backwater. I think that's changed. You don't have to deal with candidates. You don't have to deal with candidates' spouses. Generally, they're well-funded. If you have some major backers, you're able to really kind of do what you want and do it in a way where you also have control of your life. That's the other thing about presidential campaigns is they're entirely consuming. You know, it's a 24/7 job for, you know, 6, 9, 12, 15 months. I suspect these folks that are working for outside groups now are working hard, but they're not missing a lot of things that you would miss if you're working on a presidential campaign.
Matt Makowiak is consulting for an outside group called Let Freedom Ring. It calls itself nonpartisan, and according to its website, it promotes constitutional government, economic freedom, and traditional values. Now, the Supreme Court's 2010 decision that allows outside groups to raise and spend unlimited amounts of money to advocate for a particular issue or even a candidate has meant that strategists and donors are going where the money's going.
That's one of the interesting things about this, is that you're having these outside groups are playing an outsized role. Campaigns and candidates themselves have less control over the narrative, less control over the media, less control over the story, and you now have this finance system that's unlike any we've ever seen.
There's growing evidence that this election year, not just on the presidential level, but also for congressional races, this year will be dominated by super PACs. Right now, more than 80% of the money raised by super PACs has gone to pro-GOP groups. And according to the Center for Responsive Politics, 80% of all the money raised by these groups has come from just 100 individuals, the wealthiest people in America. In a moment, we'll talk to one of those donors. He gave $1.25 million to a super PAC supporting Mitt Romney. But first to Charles Homans, a reporter who writes for The New Republic. Recently, he profiled one of those donors, in fact, one of the biggest, a Texas billionaire named Harold Simmons. In mid-2010, Simmons was summoned to a meeting in Dallas.
Yeah, there was a sort of interesting meeting between Karl Rove and a number of these very wealthy business types from the sort of Dallas business community who had been longstanding supporters of the campaigns that Rove had run over the years. And he was basically coming around. He had this new organization called American Crossroads, which was going to be this sort of independent campaign organization. And he was looking to basically build a campaign war chest. And he gave this pitch to these guys, and several of them anteed in with what ultimately proved to be very large donations. And one of them was this guy named Harold Simmons.
Who is Harold Simmons?
Harold Simmons is he was pretty well known in business circles as one of the sort of corporate raiders of the mid-80s. And sort of in his later years, he'd become a more kind of conventional businessman where he had this constellation of companies, you know, including many of these sort of big industrial properties. There was a lead company, you know, sugar beet concern, and nuclear waste disposal was his other big business. So sort of big industrial businesses, basically.
We believe he is the single largest donor to Crossroads, the super PAC run.
Yeah, I believe so.
But this is not the first time he's made waves in national politics, right? I mean, 2004.
Right. I mean, he's best known for being one of several very large donors to the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth, which, of course, was this group that came out of sort of nowhere in 2004 to challenge Senator John Kerry's record in Vietnam. And if you look at the people who donated to that campaign, they were, you know, several of these Texas guys who, you know, donated to Karl Rove campaigns in the past. And a lot of them are the very big figures in sort of the upper echelons of donors this year. If you look at the top of the list, it's got most of the Swift Boat veteran donors are also on it. And Harold Simmons is one of them.
Here's something interesting that I found in articles that on the one hand, he's a huge contributor to these political super PACs. On the other hand, a huge philanthropist. I mean, he's one of the single biggest donors to the new sort of performing arts and center in Dallas.
And many of the hospitals in the Dallas area.
Hospitals.
He's contributed a great deal to medical research there, too.
Tell me about what it is that motivates him. Is he ideological?
It's hard to say because he gives very, very few interviews. And he gave an interview to the Wall Street Journal recently, which was the first I think he'd given to a major national newspaper in probably 10 years, something like that. And so you kind of have to go on the record of what he's done over the years. And he's been a reliable political contributor for quite some time now.
Mostly to Republicans.
Yeah. And I think that, I mean, if you look at his record, you can make a pretty strong case that he's not a terribly ideological guy. He has sort of business-minded, kind of old-school conservative sensibilities. But in some respects, he's fairly socially liberal.
Pro-choice, you write.
Yeah, he's described himself as saying he would probably be pro-choice if he had to pin himself down on the abortion issue. But he does have these business interests, many of which, as I said, are very large industrial properties, and they tend to, you know, come up against government regulation. And you can see how he learned fairly early on that it was important to have a say in the political process if his businesses were going to run the way he wanted to run them.
You write that he is motivated in part by a commitment to free markets, open markets, free trade, less government regulation. That's really at the core of who he is, right?
Yeah. I mean, if you look at sort of his early business dealings, you know, there were cases where he described himself in these court documents that I was looking at, his reasoning for contributing all this money to politicians. And he talked about the fight that his companies had in Congress every year over issues like agricultural tariffs. And, you know, this is a case where he was coming down on the side of what would be called protectionism.
He owned a sugar beet.
Or a processing company.
Processing company, yeah.
And, you know, their business was very much tied up in whether or not there would be tariffs on imported sugar. And so he was, in this case, you know, his interest in Congress was that these tariffs remain in place.
Which he wanted imported sugar to be taxed so he could
basically
be protected.
Right. So, and he said this, that his business would do quite poorly if they were to face that competition. So, you know, he was pro-free market except for when that got in the way of being in favor of
right.
business interests.
Right. How much money has he given so far?
I think
that we know of.
Yeah, that we know of, the number is sort of in the general neighborhood of 19 million. You know, it's sort of dicey to really put a dollar figure on a lot of these big donors right now because a huge amount of the money that's flowing into this race is going into these organizations that don't actually need to account for where the money's coming from. So that's sort of our best guess based on what he's told other reporters who he's spoken with and what's in the federal documentation right now.
Talking to people who know him, and most of them talk to you on background because, as you write, they were afraid. They're essentially afraid of him. Do you get the sense that Harold Simmons really believes this time the amount of money he gives will have a proportional impact on the outcome in November?
You know, it's hard to say, but I think if you look back to 2004 and one of his sort of close associates, you know, told me this, that the impact that the Swift Boat Veterans campaign had on the 2004 election was, you know, that was sort of eye-opening for him. And I think, you know, he said in interviews that he regrets not spending more in 2008 and that he thinks he could have stopped the election of Obama in 2008. And so I think that he's probably not inclined to make that mistake again. And based on what he's given so far, it seems like he's prepared to put a great deal of money into this race.
Charles Homans wrote about Harold Simmons in a recent issue of The New Republic. Now, we wanted to speak with Simmons, but he wasn't available, so we went down the list of the top 100 individual donors to outside political groups until we reached...
In Robertson's office?
Another billionaire.
Hello, this is Guy Raz from NPR. Is Mr. Robertson available?
Julian Robertson, who runs a hedge fund in New York. Hello, Mr. Robertson?
Yes, sir.
Hello, this is Guy Raz from NPR.
Julian Robertson is number 16 on the list of the top individual donors in the U.S. this election year. He's given $1.25 million to Restore Our Future, a pro-Romney super PAC, and this is why.
I'm a little bit in the time of life when one thinks about giving away money, and I can't think of a more worthy cause than to try to get this country into the hands of the best possible man that can run it. I think Barack Obama is a smart man that the electorate put into power without any qualifications to run the biggest business in the world, which is the United States of America. I think he's shown that while he's been in there.
Why not just give money to Governor Romney's campaign directly?
Well, I can't give very much. So this way I can give more money.
As you know, there's been a lot of discussions about all of the private money in politics this election cycle. What's your general feeling about it? Do you think that it is potentially a good thing for the future of America, or does part of it bother you?
Oh, I think part of it bothers us all. I mean, look, all I see is that here is a chance for me to affect a leadership change that is sorely needed in America. And I'm just taking advantage of that particular thing.
Julian Robertson, he's currently among the largest individual donors to the pro-Romney super PAC, Restore Our Future. Here's a question. How many super PACs do you think there are in the country today? Take a guess. 50? 75? Here's Dave Leventhal, who covers money and politics for Politico.
There's about 450, and that number is growing by the day. We'll see 2, 3, sometimes 5, even 8, 10 super PACs show up in a given week, even in a given day. And it's something where people have really become very aware of the fact that, number one, they exist, and frankly, that it's not all that hard to form one.
So we just heard about Harold Simmons. He's among the biggest fish in terms of donations to super PACs and so on this year. He and his wife have given a combined total of $19 million. Do we have an idea of the amount of total money people like him have contributed so far this election season?
We do, and it's more than $100 million. And if you check back with me tomorrow, that number will probably have gone up in the interim. There's an incredible influx of money of this kind going into super PACs.
And the only thing that they cannot do is directly coordinate with a campaign.
That's what the law says. You can't get into a boardroom with the campaign that you're supporting.
So Restore Our Future, which supports Mitt Romney, can't get into a boardroom with Mitt Romney's team and say, hey, let's talk about what we're going to do.
And chart out a course and put marks on the calendar. Can't do that. But what they can do is they can hire people who used to work with Mitt Romney or work with Barack Obama or work with any of the congressional candidates who are out there running right now.
And in fact, Restore Our Future is run by people who did work on Romney's campaign.
As is Priorities USA, the Democratic super
run by
PAC
Bill Burton.
That's run by Bill Burton and Sean Sweeney, who used to work in the White House with Barack Obama. So both sides are doing this. Now, the Republicans have really been much quicker to the punch to embrace the new rules and regulations that now exist in the United States that have ushered this era in.
How much more money is going to Republican and conservative-leaning groups than to Democrat-leaning groups?
Oh, it's about a 10-to-1 proposition.
Wow.
And again, that ratio is changing, but it definitely has allowed the Republicans to have a massive footprint when it comes to the amount of outside money flowing into the presidential race and also to some key Senate and congressional races.
Okay, the Obama campaign has something like $100+ million cash on hand, and the Romney campaign has far, far less. The question is, does that matter? I mean, if Restore Our Future, the Romney PAC, or Crossroads, which is the Karl Rove PAC that is going to support Romney, if those super PACs have a combined amount of, let's say, $50, $100 million, does it really matter how much money Obama has or Romney has in their own campaigns?
Well, you talk to a lot of Republicans and they say, hey, this is great because we are running against a candidate in Barack Obama who is the most successful fundraising candidate in the history of the United States, having spent more in the 2008 presidential election than any other candidate, any other presidential candidate or otherwise. So in a way, they see this as an opportunity for people to really play much more significant and greater role in American politics in a way that goes above and beyond what the candidates themselves are doing with their individual operations.
Every election year, more money is spent by the primary candidates. This year, with many of the restrictions lifted, when you factor in what the candidates are spending and the outside groups are spending, I mean, how much money could this all total up to?
Without question, this is going to be the most expensive federal election cycle in U.S. history. And what is that going to mean for the average voter? Well, you're going to see many more television ads, even more so than you probably ever thought that you could. You're going to hear them on the radio. Your favorite websites are going to just be plastered with digital advertisements. So if your eyes can see it, candidates are probably going to go after that platform with as much advertising as they can possibly afford, or for that matter, super PACs can go after those platforms with as much money as they can afford.
That's Dave Leventhal. He covers money and politics for Politico. Dave, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This week, a group of veterans dressed in bright orange shirts gathered in front of the World War II Memorial on the National Mall right here in Washington, D.C. Some of them were in wheelchairs, others with walkers, but all of them determined to make the journey here to pay tribute to their comrades who never made it home from Europe or the Pacific. This weekend has become known as the official kickoff of the summer, but it's also about something much, much greater.
We give thanks for those who sacrificed everything so that we could be free. And we commit ourselves to upholding the ideals for which so many patriots have fought and died.
That's President Obama from his weekly video address. We begin our program today with the voices of those who served and the memories they keep of those left behind. At the World War II monument, we came across 93-year-old Jill Knappenberger from Champaign, Illinois. She was a Red Cross volunteer who spent part of the war in a field hospital in Bastogne in southeastern Belgium.
I volunteered in 43 to serve with the American Red Cross. We served coffee and donuts and cigarettes and candy and chewing gum to the combat troops. But what we did was requested by Eisenhower. He says there's nothing worse than a homesick GI, which is true. And we were primarily morale builders, and we loved doing what we did, and they loved having us, so it was very satisfying. I was 26, and in December, I learned my twin brother, Jack, had arrived from England and moved up into Germany, and I was at Bastogne, 50 miles away, and had 2 days leave and got up to see him. He was with the 106th Infantry Division and was assigned to that division on Saturday, December 16th, and we got there, we knew we were in trouble, because the Germans were all around us. So did what we could, helped in the hospital there, American Evac Hospital. And I learned that my beloved twin brother was killed first day of the Battle of Bulge. And he's now buried in Luxembourg, a beautiful American cemetery. Devastating, of course, but when you're living in a war zone in combat, things you expect, I mean, you don't expect it, but you adjust to it. And of course, we were young and had more resistance and vitality than we do now, but it was devastating.
That's Jill Knappenberger remembering her twin brother, Jack, who was killed at the siege of Bastogne in December 1944. He was 26 years old. War often illuminates remarkable, even unlikely stories. Among the most remarkable of the Vietnam War was a stroke of luck, or perhaps a bureaucratic mix-up, that put two brothers in the same combat unit. They were from Nebraska. One was 19 years old. His name is Tom Hagel. He's now a law professor at the University of Dayton. His big brother was 21. He's Chuck Hagel, and he'd go on to serve as a U.S. senator from Nebraska.
We both put in transfers to be with each other, knowing full well that would never happen. Well, it did happen. It was amazing. So for 10 and a half months, Tom and I served literally side by side in Vietnam. And I think my mother was somewhat assured, recognizing the risk. But if you're going to be over there, if you're going to go do this, I'd just as soon have you both together and take care of each other.
Between them, Tom and Chuck Hagel left Vietnam with five Purple Hearts. In two separate incidents, both men were badly wounded. Tom saved Chuck's life the first time, and Chuck returned the favor a month later. Tomorrow, at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, both brothers, who despite deep political differences are still very close, both will attend a ceremony marking 50 years since the start of that war. Chuck Hagel will introduce President Obama. Here now is who former Senator Hagel is thinking about this weekend.
On Memorial Day, I think of all the individuals that my brother and I served with in 1968 in Vietnam. That was the Tet Offensive. That was the year we sent back more than 16,000 young Americans dead. I think of Tony Palumbo, who was killed from New York. He had, I think, a month to go before he rotated out. He was killed in May of 1968. I think of John Summers, the young 18-year-old kid from New Jersey, who was killed during the first experience that my brother Tom and I had being wounded together. But I think of those special quiet heroes who served, who came back and never expected anything in return for their service, except maybe a little respect, which unfortunately an angry, divided America didn't give them. But, you know, that was unfortunate. Another unfortunate aspect of the Vietnam War, we all went over as individuals. We didn't go over in units. We were there if we could last, exist, survive for 12 months, and then your tour duty was up, except for the regular Army people who then could be called back. But because it was a draftee war, essentially, you could get through it 12 months and you were out. And when you came back, they separated you. You flew into Oakland Travis Air Force Base. They gave you a new uniform, and they gave you travel money home. They gave you about a one-hour briefing on what your benefits are, thank you for your service, and go home and have a good life. That was partly why we had so many readjustment problems with Vietnam veterans returning. That was it. And Tom and I still stay in touch with some of our buddies from those days, but quite frankly, we've had one individual who Tom and I served with and got to know again here in the United States, a wonderful man, wonderful wife, three children, committed suicide about 4 years ago. He just never could deal with it. Two other friends of ours have had major in-and-out psychiatric ward issues at the VA, never been able to deal with it. We've got other friends who were able to deal with it, have done very well in their lives. Tom and I have been lucky that we've been able to adjust and move on.
That's former Nebraska Senator and Vietnam War vet Chuck Hagel. More than 3 million men and women have cycled in and out of Iraq and Afghanistan since 2001, and almost 6,500 troops have been killed in those wars. Even as U.S. forces begin to prepare for an eventual drawdown in 2014, Afghanistan continues to claim hundreds of casualties a month. Butch Bracknell is a lieutenant colonel in the Marine Corps. He's done tours in Bosnia, Iraq, and Afghanistan. And when we asked him who he'll be remembering this Memorial Day, he began by describing his late friend, Major Mike Weston.
He's the closest thing that you could find in a modern Superman. Mike and I were both assigned as military prosecutors at Camp Pendleton, California. Mike and I spent several weeks, maybe a better portion of a few months, working where we were with each other 60 or more hours a week. He was almost a 4.0 grade point average guy from Stanford with degrees in computer science and economics. Mike went from there to Harvard Law School. And it's an interesting story, while he was on a break at Harvard Law School, he had gone out to California on a job interview. He was flying back with a bunch of Marine Reserve guys. And he started talking to these guys, and they started yucking it up and sharing stories. And the next thing you knew, Mike had decided, you know what, that sounds like a good idea, I'm going to do that. So while all of his Harvard Law School peers were at the New York law firms and the Washington, D.C. law firms, you know, making big dollars for the summer, Mike went off to boot camp at Parris Island, South Carolina, and became an enlisted Marine reservist. That was Mike's way. He would not be told by the folks at Harvard that this is the expectation. Mike would define his own ideas of success. And he went and joined the Drug Enforcement Administration after his initial stint as an officer in the Marine Corps. And that's when he went to Richmond, Virginia, sort of the mean streets of Richmond. He was still in the Marine Reserves, and he was assigned to combat operations. And that's where Mike and I saw each other physically the last time, was around February of 2005. I was leaving a deployment in Iraq, and his unit was rotating in. And so we overlapped for about a week while we were there in Afghanistan. And we hadn't seen each other in a couple of years, and it was just like the old days. We had such a great time together. We'd go and eat at the dining facility together, and I think we watched Old School a couple of times together, and which was right up Mike's alley in terms of sense of humor. And so we had to part company after that as I was rotating home back to my family and he was coming in for his initial tour of duty. So I think that deployment was probably 7 or 8 months. He came back from that and he went back to work for the DEA. You know, most of us would want to come back from a deployment like that where you're kind of getting shot at a regular basis and you're always exposed to mortar fire or IEDs and things like that, and you'd want to take a break and go back to something sort of regular. Mike took his break and went back to the streets of Richmond, trying to interdict drugs in Richmond and with some of society's probably their worst actors. He did that until an opportunity arose within DEA for him to join basically a deployed special operations team and go do counter-narcotic work in Afghanistan. Mike was, of course, one of the first guys to get his hand in the air to get in on that big adventure. So off he goes to Afghanistan and had been there just a few weeks when they were out on a night mission and they had done a raid and they were leaving the compound that they had just secured. And as he was leaving, something happened with the helicopter, and the helicopter didn't gain altitude, and it wound up crashing back into the wall of the compound, and everyone on board the helicopter regrettably perished, not just Mike, but other DEA agents and some military folks that were supporting that mission. I felt sad for society because I knew that we had lost something great. He was the best among us. He really, everyone who knew him knew that whatever it was you were doing, Mike could do it better. And there wasn't a hint of arrogance in it. It was just pure, unbridled enthusiasm and curiosity and passion for life. That's what the world lost. That's what America lost when it lost Mike Weston.
That's Lieutenant Colonel Butch Bracknell remembering his late friend, Major Mike Weston, who died on October 26, 2009, in western Afghanistan. The stories for all our hip-hop fans out there. Are you listening? All right, it's not really a hip-hop story, but a story about a rapper with enough conspiracy, paranoia, and double-crossing. You might think Graham Greene had written his story. And the rapper in question is one of Korea's most famous. His name is Dan Lee, but he performs as Tablo.
I would say that he was part of the reason that hip-hop became big in Korea. There were certainly other artists, but he had a significant contribution to popularizing it.
That's Josh Davis. He's an editor at Wired Magazine, and he wrote about Tablo for a recent issue. Tablo burst onto the Korean hip-hop scene around 2005, young, handsome, and just back from the U.S. where he went to college.
At the time, rap was not a very popular genre in Korea. He decided to go back to where he was from and try to produce hip-hop music.
He actually had a degree, a bachelor's and a master's degree from Stanford in English.
Exactly.
So he decided, you know what, I'm going to become a rapper.
That's right.
It doesn't happen every day.
No, in fact, I mean, part of the irony of this is that in the United States, if a rapper went to Stanford, it might be held against him.
Tablo found some early success, not much.
But he really started to gain traction in 2009 and 2010. He did a tour in the United States, and he sold out major venues in New York, in San Francisco, in Los Angeles.
Including the Hollywood Bowl.
His album at that time was the number one album on the U.S. iTunes hip-hop charts, atop Jay-Z and
wow.
Eminem. So he was really on the verge of something.
I'm the top gun, drop another hot one.
Don't miss a victim, yeah.
Show me what you got. I'm the top gun, competition got none.
Don't miss a victim, yeah.
Show me what you got.
The attention paid to him skyrocketed when he married one of the top film stars. And so now you have this celebrity, this match made in celebrity heaven, and people can't believe it.
It sounds like Jay-Z and Beyonce.
It's the Korean equivalent.
Tableau was on top of the Asian hip-hop world, and then, about a year ago,
it all fell apart.
Someone began making accusations against Tableau on an internet forum.
And on this forum, anonymous individuals started posting information saying that Lee had stolen somebody's identity, had lied about his Stanford degree, was in fact not a Stanford graduate, and had basically fabricated this entire persona, all with the aim of becoming an international hip-hop star.
He went to Stanford so he could become an international hip-hop star.
You know, it doesn't make a lot of sense to us in the U.S., but certainly this accusation gained immediate traction. And within a number of weeks, hundreds of thousands of members signed up to this forum and demanded that Tableau reveal the truth.
There were a few things that seemed suspicious.
First of all, he had done his undergraduate and his master's in 3.5 years, which is quite extraordinary.
As the controversy started to take hold, Dan Lee released his Stanford transcripts and diploma.
But rather than end the matter, it only exacerbated the controversy. It basically fed food to the fire. And they then zeroed in on the diploma, and they looked for the exact placement of every comma on the diploma to see whether or not, in fact, it was a forgery. And then they charged him with forgery when they said that they felt that there were discrepancies.
Now, a little background here.
In 2007, a curator at a art museum in Seoul said that she had got a PhD from Yale. Yale, in fact, confirmed it. But it turns out that she did not get a PhD from Yale, and Yale had mistakenly confirmed the PhD. And this created a huge media sensation.
Which led to suspicions that Dan Lee, a.k.a. Tableau, was a fraud. And it began to dominate the celebrity news shows in Korea.
우선 가수 타블로가 서울 국제학교를 졸업하고 스탠퍼드 대학에서 학사와 석사를 마쳤다는 게
It affected his career. It affected his life. He couldn't go out on the streets because people were starting to threaten him.
Dan Lee's record sales plunged. He parted ways with his label. He felt they didn't do enough to defend him. And because he was among Korea's most recognized celebrities, he couldn't leave his home without being harassed.
He became a hermit at age 29.
And he started to get paranoid.
And he takes his baby daughter in to the hospital for a checkup. And he suddenly sees the nurses and the doctors looking at him, and he wonders, wait a second, are they in on it? And are they these people who are putting needles in my baby, do they hate me? Are they going to hurt me? Are they going to hurt my baby?
At that point, Stanford University, from where Dan Lee did in fact graduate, contacted reporter Josh Davis and asked him to investigate the source of the malicious accusations.
I found a number of posts from an individual online claiming to be a cousin of Dan Lee. This purported cousin accused Lee of lying and fabricating a number of elements of his academic credentials. So as I started to scroll back and read through the initial posts on these forums where people were accusing him of lies, I saw people saying, look, here's a relative. Here's somebody who says he's a relative, and this person is accusing him of lying about his academic career. And if a relative thinks it, then it really must be true.
Except it's not clear whether it was a relative or even a jealous old friend or someone who simply wanted to ruin Dan Lee's career. It took more than a year before Korean tabloids began to come around to Dan Lee's story and accept that, in fact, he wasn't lying, that he went to Stanford. But in the meantime, Dan Lee started to record a new record all about his ordeal. He called it Fever's End. This is my home, leave me alone. 여기만은 들어오지 마. 이젠 눈물 없이도 Do most people believe Dan Lee now in Korea?
I think they do. I think that the evidence is so strong in his favor that you'd really have to have a strong sense of conspiracy to not believe him at this point.
Earlier this month, 12 people who posted false accusations online were put on trial in Korea for criminal defamation against Tableau. They could face jail time. For his part, Tableau's latest record put him right back at the top of the charts. But at least for the moment, the whole episode's been so traumatic, He's not yet ready to perform publicly. All summer long, we're asking filmmakers, actors and writers and directors about the movies that have changed their lives, the ones they could watch a million times, including this one from the creator of Friday Night Lights.
Hi, my name's Peter Berg. I'm a director, and my most favorite film, the one I watch over and over and can't not watch whenever it's on, is One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, directed by Milos Forman, starring Jack Nicholson and Louise Fletcher. I first saw the film, gosh, I'm going to say 12 or 13. I'm not great with dates. I was young. I mean, it was kind of by accident. My parents, for whatever reason, thought I could handle it, and Cuckoo's Nest just hit me like a freight train. 98% of it takes place on the ward of the psych unit.
Medication time.
This group of kind of colorful characters inhabit this ward, and the ward is led by this character named Nurse Ratchet.
Good morning, Miss Ratchet.
Good morning.
And into this world comes this force of life, Jack Nicholson and his characters, Randall McMurphy.
Randall Patrick McMurphy. What can you tell me about why you've been sent over here?
I don't know. What's it say there?
He's in trouble, and so he figures he's going to take the easy way out and pretend that he's crazy, do 6 months in this cushy mental institution, and get out. And it doesn't go that way. He ends up getting very involved and caught up in the system, and his natural spirit can't tolerate that system.
The chief voted. Now, will you please turn the television set on?
Mr. McMurphy, the meeting was adjourned and the vote was closed.
But the vote was 10 to 8. The chief, he's got his hand up. Look.
No, Mr. McMurphy. When the meeting was adjourned, the vote was 9 to 9.
He goes to war with the system.
Ah, come on. You're not going to say that now. You're not going to say that now. Now, when the vote, the chief just voted, it was 10 to 9. Now, I want that television set turned on right now.
It was sort of like, F the system, you know? Even in my young mind at that time, it started landing.
Grab the fence here. Right here, Chief. Strong.
My favorite sequence in that film probably is the fishing boat sequence. From the moment Nicholson escapes, climbs over the fence, shimmies down the tree, steals the bus.
Hey, what the hell's going on here?
This crazy, crazy scene on a fishing boat. That was my favorite scene.
What are you doing on this boat?
We're going fishing.
Not on this boat. You're not going fishing on this boat.
We're from the state mental institution. This is Dr. Cheswick, Dr. Tabor, Dr. Fredrickson.
How about you? Who are you?
Oh, I'm Dr. McMurphy, R.P. McMurphy.
Last March, I turned 50, and I showed it to my son, who's 12, and he and I watched it together. And he was really into it. He was just laughing and so caught up in the kind of genius magic of the fact that somehow these guys had pulled this off. That was kind of my favorite birthday. You know, it was just very low key. We just had dinner and then we watched Once Over the Cuckoo's Nest together.
That's director Peter Berg talking about the movie he could watch a million times, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Berg is best known for Friday Night Lights, both the film and the TV show. His new movie, Battleship, is in theaters now. Now, it's not quite as dramatic as Battleship, but here's another movie story that could easily be distilled into a short movie trailer. The life of 15-year-old Jake Fushi, and this is what it would sound like if it were a trailer.
In a world where a voice can separate the boys from the men...
I about say 14 again.
Jake was actually 14 when his story began, but now...
You mean to start over?
He's 15. Sure.
One 15-year-old is walking the line and charting his own destiny. In theaters everywhere, Friday.
A little explanation here. When Jake was 13 and his voice changed, he realized his was just a little deeper than his friends.
Hello, my name is Jake. I am 14 years old.
So he decided he might want to use his voice for a career someday. So a few months ago, he posted a video on YouTube, just Jake, in front of his computer with a microphone.
I'm trying to become a voice actor, and this is my movie trailer guy impression.
in a world where the Earth was no longer in our control. With our survival at stake, we have one chance, and that chance is to fight back.
So naturally, the video goes viral. He's 14.
In theaters everywhere, Friday.
And the next thing Jake knows...
I remember that the first day I got an email from Good Morning America.
14-year-old Jake Fushi from North Carolina has become an internet sensation.
And I was insanely surprised by it, and I did not believe it. And I told my dad about it, and they didn't believe it either.
What do you want to do?
I'd like to be a voice actor when I'm older, like for movie previews or just movie trailers and stuff.
He told us Good Morning America was fun.
Welcome back to Good Morning America with Robin Roberts and George Stephanopoulou.
But his next stop was the Ellen DeGeneres Show.
Well, Jake, it's quite a voice you have. I'm excited that you're here.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
All right, so when did your voice start to get
And she sprung a surprise on you.
Yes, she did.
Right?
Yes, ma'am.
So we called the Abrams Artist Agency in New York City. It's one of the most highly regarded voiceover talent and literary agencies in the industry, and they would like to officially sign you. You have an agent.
And I was really excited about that and insanely surprised. And I couldn't even believe it.
Have you had any, have you signed a deal yet?
We haven't gotten into everything yet, but we are working with them now. My mom and my dad are all having conferences with them and getting everything worked out. So hopefully we'll get a lot of the big stuff going this summer.
Who else do you do?
I can do Optimus Prime from Transformers.
How does he sound?
Before time began. There was. The cube.
The cube. We know not where it comes
wow.
from.
That's crazy.
Thank you.
What about at school? Like, are you like the most popular kid now?
Well, a lot of people have come up to me and congratulated me, and so a lot of people are trying to be my friend now, and it's fun, but also I'm just trying to remember who my real friends are and keep everything in check.
What about dates? Any luck there?
Well, I have a girlfriend, actually, since before all this started, and still with her now. She's really happy for me, and she's with me through it all.
That's Jake Fushi. His original viral video is at our website, npr.org. Coming up, music from a new band that describes its sound as orchestral folk. That's in the next part. Excuse me. That's in the next part. Forget it. Jake, can you finish this one?
That's in the next part of All Things Considered from NPR News.
Here's a band we predict you'll be hearing a lot more of this year. It's a Denver-based group called The Lumineers. Their new album is self-titled. And this song, their new single, is called Ho Hey. When we got their CD in the mail, it included a quote from lead singer Wesley Schultz. It was published in the New York Times back in 1992 when Wesley was just 9 years old. And here's the quote. It says, "I spend a lot of time on my drawings, and it turns out real good because I've been practicing a lot." Well, the article was about a musician who was visiting Wesley's school at the time. Anyway, that quote was about wanting to be an artist. And a few years ago, a friend of Wesley's dug it up and sent it to him.
It was kind of reassuring to see that I did have some intention with that, even at an early age.
When Wesley got the quote, he'd been living in New York. This was a few years ago. And he and his childhood friend Jeremiah Freites were both working odd jobs and struggling to make it as a band. And that's when they wrote this song.
I remember, Jerry, you came over and we worked on a little bit, and our neighbor told us to stop playing because it was really loud. But
yeah, we ran through the song for maybe a minute, and then door knocking ensued about a minute and a half later. And that was our one practice day in Brooklyn at Wes's apartment.
What about the story behind the song? Is there any truth to it?
Yeah. I've been trying to do it right. Gotten my heart broken pretty good and
living a lonely life.
Just reflecting on that.
I've been sleeping here instead.
And
I've been sleeping in my bed.
I've been sleeping in my bed.
Sleeping in my bed.
It just alludes to the fact that you're on your own.
I don't know. I don't know where I went wrong, but
was the one thing that I thought I could do all right. And it might dig me out of this hole.
You guys, you grew up, you've known each other since you were kids. Grew up in New Jersey in a suburb called Ramsey. Wesley, you were actually childhood friends with Jeremiah's older brother, Josh. He was your best friend, right?
Yeah, growing up, we spent a lot of time together, often in silence, just drawing. We took classes together. I still have the notepad. I think you do too, Jer. Yeah. This yellow notepad from our classes that we worked on together and spent a lot of time over each other's houses and things like that.
Josh, your brother, he died 10 years ago, tragically died of a drug overdose when he was just 19. And the two of you got together and I guess started playing music as sort of a way to figure out how to cope with this?
Well, it's not that nicely of a package. I think the reality is that when that happened, I think, in a sense, I grew up overnight. I don't think that we would necessarily be here talking to you if he hadn't died. I don't know where I would be. I think that I'd still be making music, but I think that it really drastically altered my trajectory for the rest of my life.
Yeah, he played pretty mean guitar, too, Josh.
Yeah.
He had a Slash guitar that...
Yeah, Slash's snake bit guitar.
We would use for our first few gigs.
I stood alone upon the platform in vain.
You guys, a lot of your story is about your journey, because you started in New York, you were in Brooklyn, and then you left. You decided that New York wasn't the place for you. You sing about it in one of your songs that's called Dead Sea.
I headed west, I was a man on the moon. New York had lied to me, I needed the truth. Oh, I need...
New York had lied to me, and I needed the truth. What was the lie?
Well, I remember one of our friends and musical acquaintances out in the East Coast said the first rule of being a band, I think, is you make the nearest, largest city your mecca, and you work on that. I took that as gospel, like, oh, nice, let's just go to New York City time and time again every other week, and things will get going for us.
And it just didn't work out.
Yeah, I think we just saw the same people coming out, and we thank them to this day from the bottom of my heart.
And I was so sick of making those Evites, too, using Evite.com to get people out. Right. It was just,
So I think we just thought that if we could go somewhere where we could afford to work on music and tour, that that's probably the solution, and don't worry about how to all the other details. And that's why Denver made sense.
You, when you got to Denver, you put an ad in Craigslist looking for a cellist. The first person who responded is, in fact, your cellist.
Nila. Yeah. I think I still have the voicemail she left.
What happened when she showed up? Did you ask her to practice or to rehearse or something, or, you know, give you
I remember she showed up, and I remember Wes and I were very excited, almost giddy with excitement. She walked into our house, and...
Charlie Boy.
I think we played Charlie Boy.
Don't go to war.
And I think I was looking at Wes. Sweet, you know, and she nailed the notes perfectly and it sounded wonderful.
Lillian.
We said, wow, this is a pretty cool sound.
Don't hang your head.
Really, the rest is sort of history. I mean, she plays the cello, mandolin, even electric bass at times, and piano. Yeah, I think that's truly when the Lumineers was forged.
I'm speaking with Wesley Schultz and Jeremiah Freites of the band The Lumineers. Their new self-titled debut album is out now. Let's get to another track on the record. This one's called Big Parade.
Lovely girl, won't you stay? Won't you stay? Stay with me. All my life I was blind. I was blind. Now I see.
Lovely on this track, Big Parade, you're doing this sort of thing that you do all over the record, this energetic,
all my life I was blind,
stomp and clap kind of sound.
Now I see.
Shouting choruses, call and response. How carefully do you craft those moments?
I think we worked on it incessantly.
Yeah. I think another turning point was in New York, and we heard Exile on Main Street, and I was shocked at how it just immediately got me, and I loved the ragged, raw sound. something that I really appreciated about that sound and some of the things that we do now are in an effort to capture the flaws and the warts and all. We just love that stuff because it sounded so real.
You guys are just about to launch a national tour. You're going to go to the UK and Ireland. You're going to tour with the Civil Wars, who've been on this program, great band. What does it feel like, you know, having taken this risk, leaving New York, moving to Denver, not even knowing what was going to happen, and now people are really, you're starting to get national attention for your music?
Yeah, it feels really, really good. Wes was working as a coffee barista, and I was a barback at some crappy hometown bar, and we were ready to take the dive.
Yeah, I felt crazy for a while, like maybe I was just being super stubborn at pursuing this just to be different or something, or there's a level of validation that is nice to have so you can move on and just not worry about feeling like you might be crazy.
That's Wesley Schultz and Jeremiah Freites. They're the co-founders of the band The Lumineers. Their self-titled debut album is out now. You can hear a few tracks at our website, nprmusic.org. Wesley, Jeremiah, thank you so much, and good luck this year.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Years, the classical music world has owed a debt of gratitude to the country of Venezuela. Its youth orchestra program, El Sistema, has produced a host of up-and-coming talents, including, of course, its most famous graduate, L.A. Philharmonic conductor Gustavo Dudamel. Now, another Venezuelan is starting to get a lot of attention, Vanessa Perez. Vanessa Perez began making international appearances at the age of 8. When she was just 14 years old, she met the legendary pianist Claudio Arrau, and he was blown away. He said her technique, her musicality, her intelligent approach to the music she plays, well, it made a profound impression on him. And that praise carried Vanessa Perez to a new level. She's now a veteran pianist, and she's just released a new album of Chopin's Complete Preludes. Vanessa Perez stopped by NPR on a recent visit to Washington, D.C., and we asked her to join us right in NPR's performance studio. Vanessa Perez, thank you so much for joining me here at NPR's Grand Piano in Studio 4A.
Thank you.
For people who don't play piano, and can you explain why Chopin's preludes are particularly worthy of the treatment that you've given them on this record? Because it is a record of Chopin preludes.
His melodies are some of the most gorgeous melodies ever written. He was the poet of the piano. And he speaks through the piano in such an intimate way that he is his voice. And there's this constant, constant longing and nostalgia that I think that's why even when I'm in the audience listening and the interpreter is about to play Chopin, you feel immediately a sense of, it's like your home. It's like, you are on earth.
Yeah.
When you hear his music because of its beauty, if its line, of what it touches in your heart.
And a lot of people think of him primarily as a composer, but he was a virtuoso pianist,
yes,
as well.
Yes, he was.
Franz Liszt wrote a biography about him.
Yes, he was a virtuoso in a different way than Franz Liszt. Franz Liszt was the flamboyant.
Yes, the rock star of his age.
He added things to make everything even more flashy.
Yeah.
And Chopin, in these preludes, he uses technique to actually, is all in service of the music. So the difficulties that one encounters, which some are very challenging, you'll be running all over the piano, but it's in the service of that emotion that he wants to convey.
Well, Vanessa, it would be a waste to have you here in NPR's performance studio without asking if you could perform one of those preludes. Can you tell us which one you'll start with?
I will start with the E minor sostenuto prelude, number 4. Thank you.
Oh, it was absolutely beautiful. That's Vanessa Perez here in NPR's Performance Studio 4A, playing Chopin's Sostenuto Prelude number 4 in E minor. In the booklet
yes.
that is in the CD, Chopin is described as someone who refuses to be predictable.
Yes.
Can you explain that to me and maybe even show me on the piano what that means?
Well, he goes from one atmosphere to another. He can be in, and I'll show you now, he can be in a very hopeful state, and in a matter of seconds, he goes to the underworld. The famous Raindrop Prelude, that with just one note, he goes from one harmony to another, but he keeps the same note. So this is the Raindrop. So we're in hope. No, we're not. So we go to the darkest underworld, and then after that. To prayer. But there's threat.
It is.
It's a genius.
incredible. It really is. Yeah. And it's so powerful. I mean, you're a bit yes. You're even a bit emotional.
Yeah, it's just that it never ceases to. I'm at home practicing, and I'm like, how
just
did
weep.
He think? Yeah. How did he do this?
It's incredible.
Yeah.
I want to ask you about your background,
yes,
because
yes.
you were born in the U.S. in Miami.
Yes.
But you were raised
in Venezuela.
In Venezuela.
My father is Venezuelan. I'm Venezuelan American. I have both citizenships.
Were you one of those kids whose parents forced her to play the piano?
No.
No? They didn't sit on you and say, practice, practice, practice.
Well, they did. Actually,
they did
my
that.
Mom did. I think for all disciplines, because at the end, music is a discipline, you need a parent to be saying, okay, you need to practice this much, because otherwise you won't see the progress. A lot of children were making music there. Our concert halls are full of young people. Some of them feel like rock concerts there.
Wow.
So no, I was forced to practice longer than I wanted to,
but it was you who wanted to.
But I wanted to all the time.
And
actually, the threats were: if you don't practice as much as I want you to, my mother, I'm calling your piano teacher right now, and that would make me just run back.
Were you always sort of made to play the piano for your parents' friends growing
up? Oh my God. Yes, I was the entertainment.
They had
of the
to show
house.
You off.
Yes, that part I wasn't always crazy about, I have to say, because I felt like, no, this is abuse. I'm not a monkey. But but it was fun, too. But yes, sometimes it was constant. Any visit that we had at home, Vanessa. So
I was reading about an encounter you had, a person you met. When you were just 14 years old, one of the great pianists of the 20th
century. It was with Claudia Rao. That encounter was what gave me strength throughout the years, to see somebody so great, so humble, though, and to have these conversations and see that this genius man was so approachable, so down to earth, and gave me such words of inspiration and encouragement. For someone like that to believe in you changes your life, because you feel, okay, if he believes in me, I can do things. And so even if life, you know, sometimes as it does hits you, you can go on, you know.
He died just 2 years later.
Yes, shortly after.
It's amazing how those encounters can have such a profound effect on musicians. We talked to a jazz musician, Christian McBride, a couple months ago, and he talked about meeting Wynton Marsalis, and it changed his life. those moments and what those people say to you,
yes,
can really
change everything. Yes, forever. Actually, he gave me advice too that I was not getting at the time. My piano teachers at the time were very like, your piano's your husband and you don't look. And he was actually, no, enjoy, look everywhere. This is what's going to nurture everything, every part. And so after that, nobody could tell me that again.
Vanessa Perez's new record is called Chopin, The Complete Preludes. It is out now. Vanessa Perez, it has been an absolute pleasure having you come into Studio 4A. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And would you be so kind as to leave us with one more performance?
Yes. I will play number 24, D minor. This was a very fateful prelude. In a way, contrasting to the minor sostenuto, there's a more desperate sentiment.
For the week ending May 27th, 2012, that's the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered. Our program is directed by Phil Harrell. Our production staff includes Petra Mayer, Brent Bachman, Lauren Silverman, Lily Percy, Amy Held, and Walter Ray Watson. Mathoni Maturi is our senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Guy Raz. We're back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. And thanks for listening.